Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031.
You can also visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. But we do want to encourage you to send us your observations, questions and wildlife recordings by using our designated WhatsApp number. It is, you've just heard it there, 087 708 7031. Go to the website, all the details are there if you can't get the number down quick enough. We've got a very busy programme ahead of us today and we're looking forward to speaking with you again. Niall Hatch is in studio with me. Aina Nealana is in County Clare. Richard Collins is out there in Malahide. Terry Flanagan is down in Herbert Park and Dr. Matthew Jebb from the National Botanic Gardens will be joining us, about 6:15 or thereabouts. But Niall, can I start with you, if you don't mind? Because last night I was at home and I was watching TV, as you do. I was watching that movie Airplane. Remember the movie Airplane?
Oh,
it's one of my favourites. It's been on all week. It's fantastic.
What kind of plane is it? Oh, it's a big, pretty white plane with red stripes, curtains in the window and wheels, and it looks like a big Tylenol.
And as I was watching the movie, I thought I heard a bird singing, and I was wondering where it was coming from. So I went over to the chimney, and I stuck my microphone up the chimney.
Sounds like a blackbird.
And I said, it sounds like a blackbird. And it was. You could hear it singing very clearly. Then I thought I'll go outside and have a look.
I think I'll go outside and have a look and see if that bird is on my chimney. Or is it just nearby?
So I walked out and I can tell you I was wearing a lovely pair of shorts and my Crocs and a simple t-shirt. There it is, the blackbird singing.
Yep, right on top of the chimney cap. It's a blackbird.
So my question to you, Niall Hatch, is why did it choose the chimney cap in the first place? I know they want to get the highest point and all that. Was it because it was just the highest point, or was there a benefit to the kind of reverberation of the chimney itself? Because you could hear how loud it was, but it was inside the chimney when I had my mobile phone stuck up the chimney.
Oh, maybe it just wants to get on the radio. Maybe that's what the motivation was. No, I think that it must have started obviously because it's the highest point, because the blackbird couldn't have known in advance before it started this behaviour that it would get a benefit from singing in that location. So they like to go to a high perch. They can broadcast then over a wider range. So obviously it must have started by singing from a high point, but then it would have probably realised there was a benefit to this, because all of a sudden its own voice would have sounded richer and more amplified because it was being amplified by the cavity in the chimney. And therefore that bird would probably use that now as a favourite perch. So I hope you don't mind being disturbed by blackbirds when you're watching old comedy films, because it'll probably happen again and again. This blackbird has learned that this is the great spot to go to for its dusk chorus. So it's really interesting to hear it. It's amazing how clear that was as well, that you could hear that loudly down in your living room.
It was extraordinary. It really was. I was watching the movie and I could hear the sound and I thought, where's that? It's coming from the fireplace. It is. Has this bird missed its opportunity? It's singing very late.
Well, it is. It should be on its second brood now if it has successfully mated. So there is still territory to be defended. It is still putting rival males on notice that this is its patch. They're not welcome. There's obviously a first brood of juvenile blackbirds out now. Not its own blackbird chicks, but also ones from the neighbours as well. And it doesn't want them in its garden too, competing with its own chicks for food. So from that point of view, it might be warning them off. So it is quite normal for blackbirds to still sing at this time. But in the next few weeks, that'll definitely die down and eventually disappear. Once the second brood of chicks is out and about, then the blackbird male will be onto other things. We've got other concerns.
All right, let's say hello now to Aina Nealana, who's in County Clare. How's the weather in County Clare today, Aina?
The weather is glorious in County Clare. It's like a different country. But your remarks about the blackbird coming to your chimney pot, you're not with it at all. John Drinkwater, who was a poet in Britain way back 100 years ago, wrote a whole poem about this. And he said, "He comes on chosen evenings, my blackbird bountiful, and sings over the gardens of the town just as the hour the sun goes down." And the poem goes on about how beautiful the blackbird sounds. And at the end he says, "Figured above our garden plots, those are celestial chimney pots." So he was so impressed by the blackbird on the chimney that he wrote a whole poem about it, Derek. Are you moved to poetry yourself?
Richard, any birds singing on your chimney pots?
Not at the moment, Derek, but they do sometimes. I have some jackdaws nesting about
10 metres from there on the house next door, and I have house sparrows, but it's very interesting.
It is very interesting. Now, I observed something else the other day, and it has to do with the way birds walk. This is one for you, Richard, because you said to me before that when it comes to the corvids, the crow family, it requires a great deal more brain power to walk than it does to hop. So I went along to the River Dodder to have a look at a crow, because I see crows along the River Dodder at a particular point all the time when I'm walking up and down there just past Bald's Bridge. Have a listen to this.
I'm looking at a hooded crow. Now, this bird cannot be mistaken for any other member of the corvid family, because it's got a black head, a black hood, black wings, black tail, black legs, and the rest of its body is kind of an ashy grey colour. And it's just here on the River Dodder. Well, I should say it's on a bit of a sandbank on the River Dodder, where the water level is quite low and it's running either side of the sandbank. And it's full of stones and sand and vegetation. And there's even some old red bricks, probably from a refurbishment job on one of the cottages there in Dodder View. But the reason I'm here is to follow this crow. There's always crows here. I see them all the time. And this fella is just sauntering along. He's not in any hurry. It's like left, right, left, right, left, right. That's the pace of it. It's not in a hurry anywhere. And I know that yoga lovers will already know this. There's an exercise or position, however you describe it in yoga, which is called the crow walk. You get into the squat position, rest your hands on your knees, and then you walk around the floor. Left, right, left, right, left, right. And that's the pace. Now, this bird is here obviously looking for food. I wonder, is it fishing? Because I've heard that some crows do actually fish. And I know they eat mollusks and crabs and mussels and you name it. They pick them up, fly up into the air, drop them down, break them open and get at the meat. But this guy's just walking along casually. I'll put the video on the website so you can see it. With its mouth open. Now, it is kind of warm today. It's not so cold. All that rain is gone. So that's the hooded crow. It could have been any crow. I just picked this one because it was here. And its name in Irish is Carroglia, the grey crow.
The grey crow. Apologies for the poor recording. I was using my mobile phone, and that's what we want you to do, is to use your mobile phone to make recordings, send us in messages and questions, and then WhatsApp to 087 708 7031. It's really simple. Just make the recording and send it to us via WhatsApp. So back to the question, Richard College. You said that the birds that walk have greater brain power than the birds that hop. Is it true?
Well now, Derek, I suggest an experiment. When you leave the studio, don't walk to your car. Hop, hop to your car.
I can't hop, hop. I've got a dodgy back.
Well, let's suppose you were a normal person qualified to hop. But if you did, what would you find? You would find that you were exhausted in no time. You wouldn't be able to hop all the way home. It would be impossible. Now, what's going on? The energy that you use jumping up becomes gravitational energy, potential energy, and then you fall back down again. And when you fall back to the ground, you make noise. You disturb the ground. A shockwave runs off through the ground. So the energy out of your muscles that went to lifting you up in the hop now ends up dissipated in the ground. So you lose all the energy. Now, consider a trampoline with children jumping up and down on the trampoline. When they come down, the energy goes into elasticity and fires them back up again. And that's, for instance, what kangaroos do. Kangaroos are the great hoppers among the mammals. But the kangaroo has a long tendon. And when he lands from a hop, the tendon stretches and it holds the gravitational energy of the hop and he can reuse it. So it's a very effective solution to the problem. Now the birds therefore would be better off walking than hopping. If you're up in a tree flitting from branch to branch, yes, you just jump from this branch to the next. Walking is no use to you in a tree. But if you're on the ground like crows and starlings and things a lot, then left, right is the way to go. Now, does it demand a greater effort? It does. Remember what you have to do. You can't just hop along. That's effortless. You can hop if your legs were tied together, and you would hop if you were in a sack race.
Yeah.
But if you want to walk, what you have to do, that child, watch the child at the very young age when he starts to walk at first, he puts the leg out, then he's got to learn to shift the balance, the center of gravity over the leg, then lift up the other leg, put that out, shift the center of gravity back there. It's quite a complex operation, a higher order obligation. But that, I think, is what is dictated there.
Yes, it is interesting to see the difference between the birds that hop and the birds that walk. And there are very few that do both, actually. It's usually either or. It's not obviously something that most birds are consciously doing. But we
blackbirds.
Blackbirds mostly.
Speaking of which, yeah, walk and hop.
They walk and hop, but it's mostly hopping. That's the default mechanism. So I think what happens when they're walking, it takes more deliberate concentration. Now, hopping is very good if you want to spring into the air quickly to avoid a predator. It's very efficient that way. A lot of birds that would be spending most of their time in trees tend to hop because it's a very efficient way to get off the branch. You get that spring from the branch. However, if you're carefully searching for food on the ground, if you get the majority of your food from the ground, you're going to be more deliberate in the way you walk. You want to be able to take your time. You want to be able to make more subtle movements, I suppose, to exploit the food. That's very much what crows do. When you see them walking, they have this waddle to them. You see the sort of the rear end shifting from side to side. But if you watch their heads stay very fixed. They're keeping their gaze in a very fixed position, and they're very good at doing that. You see other birds like pigeons, they have a very distinctive way of walking. They bob their heads back and forth, and there's quite a few birds that do that. Chickens do it as well. And if you notice, what they're doing there is they're often holding their head fixed in a position even when their body is walking. So they're kind of catching up with their heads. But also it's thought to increase their depth perception because they have quite a narrow field of view in terms of the overlap in the front. They have a wide field of view around the sides, but the actual overlap, so they can see three dimensions, it's very narrow. So they're not very good at judging depth. But if they bob their heads back and forth, it gives them more frame of reference to see where objects actually are. So that's one of the theories behind why birds bob their heads when they walk.
All right, Aina.
Yes, I was just saying jackdaws and rooks can both walk and hop. I used to have children in school looking out the window and observing how they moved. But at least they all go front ways. Imagine if you were a poor crab and you could only walk sideways. Now that would be shkelele altogether. And crabs can only walk sideways. And this is because their knees are at the wrong angle. Our knees, when we walk, they go out in front of us. And then we have hips that can move our legs anyway. So we can walk front ways and back ways and sideways and every other way. But the crab's legs are fixed to its body and its knees are outward, so the crab can only walk sideways. And in fact, if you're a lobster, you can walk backwards into a trap and then you can't get out again. So, you know, walking forwards is something that we think, well, everybody moves forward, but not all the creatures in the world move forwards. So imagine if you were condemned, Derek, to only moving sideways because your knees were like that. How would you even say your rosary or kneel down or anything?
How would you keep a career on the road? Anyway, Niall, what about the pied wagtail now? So the pied wagtail walks occasionally, but it always seems to be running. No, walking very fast.
It kind of scurries.
But it scurries, yeah, I was about to say. It scurries.
It reminds me of a little clockwork toy. Like, it looks like someone just wound it up and let it go.
Yeah.
And off it goes. And that's, again, a bird that spends most of its time on the ground, especially when it's foraging. They do sleep up in the trees and they can perch in trees, but they spend most of their time on the ground. And it's a very deliberate way in which they walk to try and find food. But they do always seem to be in a hurry. Very often they'll even run away rather than fly away if danger is threatening them. It's only if something was to run at them or pounce that they would actually take flight. And when they fly, they can fly very well. But they're a great example of a bird that scurries along the ground. Other birds like larks and pipits, they do the same thing as well.
Let's say hello to Terry Flanagan, who's our man on the ground with his eye on nature. Terry, where are you today?
Well, I'm on the River Dodder, very close to where you were during the week. The Dodder, it's one of many rivers in Dublin, but believe it or not, it's one of the very few rivers that's above ground. I know people think of the Liffey, it runs through the centre of the city, and the Talca's on the north side, and the Poddle's in the city centre, the Camac out in Clondalkin, where I used to work. But the majority of rivers, they actually flow below ground. Anyway, I'm on the Dodder River Walk, and that's most definitely above ground. I'm between Ballsbridge and the Aviva, close to the Dodder View Cottages and Marian College, and I'm following the flow of the river as it's travelling northwards. Now, across the river from me at the moment is the distinctive swastika chimney, that's left of the famous swastika laundry that was established about 100 years ago. Now, did I dream this, Derek, or did you once tell me that your dad actually worked there?
My father worked there for 25 years.
really.
And if I'm not mistaken, was given a gold watch when he retired, which was no longer gold after a month or two. But he did. He worked there. And there was a big swastika on the top of the chimney. And it said in big white letters running vertically down the chimney, "Swastika Laundry." And the vans used to run around. During the Second World War, there were vans on the road in Ireland. It must have been an odd sight for some people. It was a symbol of good luck and peace, as I understand it, back in the day.
An ancient symbol from Eastern religions and philosophies, absolutely. Mm.
Yeah, the chimney is still here, but the swastika's gone, all right. I think the chimney is actually preserved. And I remember they were famous for those electric vans. Do you remember those? I remember them in the 60s going around the city, the red vans with the white swastika on it. Anyway, you were talking earlier about movement in wagtails and how they walk.
Yes.
Well, we've got grey wagtails here, and I'm watching their movement in three dimensions, no less. They feed exclusively on aquatic insects, and there's a myriad of midges here today. And what they're doing is they're walking along the ground, picking up little bits and pieces of whatever they can, and then darting up into the air and catching the insects and dropping back down to the ground again. Now, that may sound easy enough to do, but really, because their movement is in 3D, and Niall kind of touched on it there earlier on, they have to have what's referred to as stereoscopic vision. They actually see in stereo. Most people think of stereo as what you hear, but you can see in stereo. And for that, you need to have your two eyes facing forward, so you get a kind of a double image. The old saying, eyes to the front, likes to hunt. Eyes to the side, likes to hide. That tells us whether an animal is a predator or a prey animal. And really, when I was trying to explain this to kids in school, I always thought of Gordon Banks. Gordon Banks was a famous goalkeeper. He played for England in the World Cup final in 1966. He played again in 1970. He was at the top of his game. And the following year, or maybe 2 years later, 71 or 72, he was involved in a car accident and he lost an eye. Now, as soon as he lost an eye, he had to give up the game. And people couldn't understand that. They'd say, but sure, look, all you have to do is move your head a little bit more left or right and you can still see everything. Yeah, he could see where the ball was, but he couldn't see where exactly it was. He could see the ball, but he couldn't see exactly where it was. So that he goes to close his hand and the ball's gone through his hands or it hasn't come there already. So it's the same idea with predators. They have to see in stereo. So these birds here, it's not only difficult for them to walk, but it's also very difficult for them to fly and to be able to catch insects.
But they're not feeding on the wing the entire time like swallows or swifts, are they? I mean, they're leaping off the ground, if you like, up into the air and try to catch something and then back down again. Isn't that the case,
yes,
or am I wrong?
No, you're dead right. But I'm watching them here this afternoon for the last half hour or so. And there's a ton of midges here. And you can see them in the sunlight. They're taking more insects on the wing than they're taking on the stones around them. So they are, I would say 90% of the insects that they're taking in the last half hour here, they've been taking them on the wing. Now, they're very, very small, so they're going to expend a lot of energy, so they don't want to get it wrong. I know there's a fair bit of protein in the insects, but they have to eat quite a lot of them. So they're very successful. I know when you take leopards and tigers and cheetahs and things like that, they generally only have one kill in every 10 or so. These guys here, they're getting it much more than that.
Anything else of note there, Terry?
Well, I'm also watching the mallard. I know you spoke last week about sexual dimorphism.
We did.
The male and the female look totally different. It's quite easy to tell them apart. Well, there's plenty of mallard down here, and it's very easy to tell them apart, but the majority of them are males. And what's been happening, I've noticed here too, is that these males, they appear to harass the females, or they're forcing themselves on them. These females, they look like they're unattached females or those that have already lost a clutch. I know it's referred to as forced copulations and it may involve several males chasing a female and mating with her. Now, it's actually been suggested that these females, they elicit this behaviour themselves by flying over the territory of other males. Evolutionary biologists believe that the female mallards encourage these forced copulations to raise the odds of successful fertilisation. In other words, if they're only mating with one male, well, he might be an okay, his genes might be okay. But if there's other males there as well, maybe if she mates with them, so she'll have a kind of a mixture of this sperm. In other words, it increases the genetic diversity. They're really seeking better genes. So there's been quite a lot of that happening here over the last couple of weeks or so. And I know people have mentioned it to me and have mentioned it to you and to others on the show there as well.
I would have thought it was a bit late now, no?
Well, ducks are very opportunistic and they may have lost their clutches. And the males, of course, it's no real investment to them whether they mate or not with a female. So they'll try it any time that they can. The female is much more selective. So there's times that she wants to avoid the males completely. And normally a female that has ducklings at the moment would want to avoid the males. So it could be if a female is flying over trying to attract the attentions of the males that she doesn't currently have a clutch. It is getting towards the end of the breeding season, although ducks do have quite a wide breeding season. Now, what's interesting there, of course, is that when you have a whole load of males competing for the female, the one who is the fittest and the strongest and the most aggressive, he's the most likely to be able to win the competition between the males to mate with her. So from that point of view, any offspring that she has, particularly male offspring, there's a good chance that they will inherit that aggression and that successful mating capacity, and therefore that her genes will be passed on to the next generation through her sons. So this is something really interesting that happened. It seems very brutal and very aggressive, but there's an advantage to the female here as well, strange as that may seem. Now, one of the things that we're seeing every year, we get lots of calls into the program, I know, from people who think that all the male ducks disappear later in the summer. So at the moment, there are lots of males around, but from sort of July and August, that kind of time, people think that the males completely disappear. You don't see them with their green heads and their curly tail feathers. You just see the females around the place. But actually what happens is the males go into drag, essentially. They change into female-style plumage, and that's sort of a camouflage that they have at that stage. Because ducks have a very weird molting strategy. All birds molt their feathers. They have to replace them. Most birds, what they do is they molt one flight feather on each wing, and that gets replaced before the next one falls out. For some reason, ducks have evolved to lose all their flight feathers simultaneously, which means that for a small, short period of time in the late summer, they become completely flightless. And all of a sudden, that flashy male plumage, very gaudy, very colourful.
It's gone.
Yeah, because it would be a liability. They'd be very obvious to predators when they can't escape. When the male can fly, he can look as flashy as he wants because he can get away from the fox or the cat. But when he's flightless, he can't. So he goes into plumage that very closely resembles that of the female, very, very brown. The way you can tell the difference, though, he keeps his yellow beak. So the female has an orange and brown beak, and the male has a yellow beak, and he keeps that all year.
You know the old saying, if it looks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, then it is probably a duck. Where does all that come from? Because everybody can identify a duck, even if we don't know what kind of duck it is. How do we even know it's a duck?
Well, I think it is one of the most familiar birds. At least some of the ducks are. We're often talking about the mallard. Everyone knows that that's a duck, and that's the one that mainly quacks. In fact, there are over 25 different species of duck regularly seen in Ireland, some very common, some very rare. Very few of those quack. The mallard quacks, the gadwall quacks, but the other ducks, they whistle and they snort. They make all these different kinds of noises. Oh. We've heard the noise that eiders make. Remember what documentary did of those? Make that mooing sound. And it's very distinctive sound that they make. So it's very few duck species that actually quack. And there's quite a few duck species, I think, that may not quite look like ducks to people. If you look like birds like red-breasted mergansers or gooseanders, these are members of the saw-billed duck group. They don't have the big flat duck beak we all associate with ducks. They have pointed, narrow beaks with little teeth along the edge, or pseudo-teeth. It's serrations on the edge that look like saws. And they don't immediately look like ducks, at least in terms of their beak shape. So I think, though, that this expression came from the fact that for the mallard, the one we're all familiar with around our towns and our cities and our duck ponds, it's a very instantly identifiable bird. Even small toddlers can identify that immediately as a duck.
That's a duck, they say. That's a duck, ain't it?
Yeah, and of course, farmyard ducks they quack, obviously, and people had flocks of ducks more frequently than they do now. And of course, they're very closely related to the mallard, and mallards can actually breed with farmyard ducks, and you get queer-looking feathers on them sometimes indeed. But I'm amused at the males, the big manly males ganging up on the poor female and four or five of them chasing her. Oh, they're all men together now. But when July and August comes, oh, now they've taken off their male clothes and they're pretending to be women because they're afraid they'll be eaten by cats. What kind of a crowd are ducks?
Terry, thank you very much indeed. You can go home now.
Okay, cheers, Derek.
Talk to you later on. Don't forget you can contact us by email. You can email mooney@rte.ie. You can send a text message to 51551, or you can send a WhatsApp observation to 087-708-7031.
Email mooney@rte.ie. Take a look at our website, rte.ie/mooney.
You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, a campaign is underway to get legal protection for basking sharks in Irish waters. I always thought they were protected, but you learn something new every day. Anyway, to tell us more about it, we've got Simon Barrow of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. Hello, Simon. Thanks for talking to us. Whereabouts are you today?
Hello, Derek. I'm sitting on the shores of Pulbeg Marina here in Dublin City. I'm about to head out to Dublin Bay to do some work. But what we're really here to talk about is the proposal to the Dáil to give basking sharks legal protection in Irish waters. A proposal by Jennifer Whitmore, TD, in Wicklow, to add basking sharks to the fifth schedule of the Wildlife Act, and this would give them legal protection in Irish waters. As many of your listeners will know, basking sharks are this awesome creature that we are home to in the spring and summer. Estimates are that we might be home to 10 to 20% of the global population of this threatened shark species. And there's huge cultural contacts with West Coast communities historically in Ireland. Basking sharks are protected in other states, including the UK, but they're not protected in Ireland. So this bill is to give them that legal protection. And as part of our campaign, there's a petition that we're asking people to sign, just to give the government the true feeling of people's interest in sharks and why we should protect them.
Protected from what though, Simon? We haven't hunted basking sharks off the west coast of Ireland since the 50s and early 60s, if I'm not mistaken.
Historically, there was a huge fishery for basking sharks, as you said. But basking sharks were actually still killed in European waters up to 2006. So they're still suffering from that heavy exploitation. But I suppose you're right. Modern threats to basking sharks are not fishing. They're more like habitat disturbance, habitat degradation. There is still a reasonable high level of ship collision. They are still bycaught accidentally in gill nets. But I do think, yes, I think the real measure would be to give us the legal framework to protect the habitat, to protect disturbance, to stop them being deliberately harassed. There is nothing to stop anybody going and driving over a shark in a rib or go and harass them in a tour boat or a kayak. So we think that's not right. Because the important thing to remember, Derek, is that even though we see sharks feeding in Irish waters in the spring on seasonally abundant zooplankton, there's great evidence that these aggregations on the surface are not just for feeding, but they're for breeding and courting as well. So by getting too close and disturbing these sharks can have a profound impact on their reproduction. So look, no one's going to wave heavy legislation at somebody, but if you have the legal framework to back up a management, at a time when Irish coastal waters are under unprecedented pressure from wind farm developments, from marine spatial planning. So there's a huge legal framework that's coming through the Irish government. So this could be part of it. And I think also we owe it to sharks, to be honest, that we've hunted them for hundreds and hundreds of years and reduced their populations hugely. So while there could be some evidence the populations are increasing, they're still under pressure from different threats. So I think we owe it historically to give basking sharks the legal protection in Irish waters while we can.
Back in 1971, when Charlie Haughey was in power, Irish waters were designated a whale and dolphin sanctuary. And I'm just wondering, what difference did that make to cetaceans living in our coastal waters or migrating through our coastal waters? And what difference will your petition, if successful, make to basking sharks?
The designation of Irish waters a whale and dolphin sanctuary at the time was, I say, ridiculed both internally and externally, because there was no extra legislation that was empowered when Charles Haughey declared it. But there was two important things to that declaration. One is that he talked about protecting whales and dolphins in the European exclusive economic zones, out to 200 nautical miles, so beyond, if you like, the reaches of the Wildlife Act. So that was a very important state, that they recognised that even offshore, whales and dolphins should be protected legally. But also what it did is it raised awareness. A lot of people didn't realise that we had not just whales, but huge populations and huge diversity of whales in Irish waters. And I think this legislation for basking sharks can do the same thing. The people will be saying, what? We have sharks? The second biggest fish in the world, up to 12 metres in length, 3.5 tonnes. We have sharks in Irish waters. But not only that, we are globally important for these sharks, so we have a global responsibility to make sure we protect them. So I think the bill, if it goes through, will give that awareness, and it will give the mechanism to provide funding for research and monitoring, to develop a code of conduct that we can roll out so people know how to approach sharks so as not to disturb them. So I think that kind of level of education awareness is critical, and I think the bill will really help that. So we do think that it will have a positive impact on the conservation status of bass sharks in Irish waters, and we urge not just the government to support it and to pass it, but for people to support it, because it's a shared responsibility, and we want to embrace that with our coastal communities, fishermen and everyone else who uses the sea.
So with a designation comes more funding, is that the case, and you can carry out more research?
Obviously, if they were designated as a protected species, it would help funding, but not just funding to understand more about them, but to funding to raise awareness and to make people more aware of the importance of Ireland for basking sharks. But there's interesting, you know, we're living in an unprecedented time of global change. And it's been said that basking sharks would make really good indicators of changes in our zooplankton population. And as you know, zooplankton is at the very foot of the food chain. So we already know zooplankton populations are responding to increasing water temperatures driven by climate change. So how these zooplankton distribution changes and associated fish and everything else associated with the zooplankton, it's very hard to monitor. But if you monitor the basking sharks that are inextricably linked to things like Callanus zooplankton, then you'll get some idea of these changes. And there's a really good project up in Northern Ireland called Sea Monitor. And last week, my colleague Emmett was out tagging basking sharks off Mayo, off Achill Island, ironically, the place of the best documented basking shark fishery in the world, where they had killed up to 1,500 in a single year in the 50s. He was tagging them with transponders and satellite tags. And the idea is that if you start building up a marked population of basking sharks using these transponders that can last up to 5 to 10 years, we'll get a really good idea of how their distribution changes, we'll get some idea of numbers, we'll get some idea of how they're responding to changes in water temperature and zooplankton distribution. So I think could be a really important a species to add to a suite of monitoring protocols we roll out, as well as their just importance in Irish waters. So it's two-ended, really, Derek. You're right. I think it will help to get funding. It will make us do more towards monitoring their populations. It will raise awareness in our coastal communities. It will lead us to develop a code of conduct for people to follow when approaching basking sharks, because they're important for marine tourism. If you've ever seen a basking shark in Irish waters, you will never forget it. They are the most incredible species to experience. And I swear, you see them once, that memory will stay with you the rest of your life.
Well, Simon, thank you very much indeed. We'll let you go about the business of the day. Be careful on those rocks down there, won't you? And good luck with the petition.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks for your interest. And please support the petition, which is online on baskingshark.ie for all your information on basking sharks in Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And we'll put those details also on our website, which is rte.ie/money. I've never actually seen a basking shark in the wild. Obviously, we feature them on Back from the Brink and Nature Live, those programmes you did with the European Broadcasting Union. Have you ever seen one in the wild, Niall, yourself?
I have. I remember seeing one off Loophead and it was phenomenal. This huge, very slow-moving fish just going offshore. I could see the fin coming out of the water. Proper shark fin. Absolutely massive. It was magical.
When you say fish, people don't believe you that sharks are fish. They don't think of sharks as being fish. I don't know what they think of them being. Man-eaters, perhaps, is what their impression is from watching movies like Jaws, etc., etc. But we've come along way, thank God. Now, Simon said the second largest fish in the sea, the biggest fish in the sea, the whale shark.
The whale shark, yes, an absolutely massive fish. I think the biggest specimen ever was almost 19 metres long, weighing 19 tonnes. They live more in tropical waters. They need to be sort of in middle latitudes. They wouldn't really be comfortable in Irish water. I think they need a sea temperature of 21 degrees centigrade, but absolutely massive fish. And like the basking shark, plankton feeders, so there's no threat to people there whatsoever.
And a huge tourist attraction, and a lot of debate about whether or not you should get into the water and swim with these creatures. Perhaps not, I think. At least with the basking sharks, people maybe are going down on boats to have a look or looking from the headland and having a look out to see them. They come very close to the shore, I know that. So anyway, thank you very much indeed, Simon. And details about the petition can be found, petition, Gumaleshgale, on our website, rte.ie/money. Do petitions work, Niall? Have you ever been involved in them? Birdwatch Ireland, I'm sure, must have been over the years.
Oh, absolutely. They can be a very effective tool, and there's many different types. I think probably the most interesting one I was involved with, and one of the most pressing, was actually at the behest of our BirdLife International partners in France, called the LPO. And they did a petition around saving the Ortolan bunting.
Oh, yeah.
This is well, we've spoken about it on the programme before, but it's the little songbird, the small, like, it's almost sparrow-like creature. And what they do is that they would catch these in big numbers. This horrible situation where they trap them, they blind them, and then they force feed them. When they're blind, apparently, when they've lost their eyes, they gorge themselves, they fatten them up, drown them in Armagnac, I think it is, and then they would eat them whole with a handkerchief tied over their eyes so that God couldn't see their shame. Really, really cruel, but also a species that's really under threat. So our colleagues in France asked if we would help with this petition. They asked people all over Europe, and that international pressure was really important, because countries do care what their international reputation is like. Obviously,
some do,
that's true. And obviously politicians often care about what their own voters think about too. So I think a combination of the two works very well. But this got a lot of attention in France, that people in Ireland and in Britain and in Germany and in Spain were appalled by this horrible practice. And the thing is, it is illegal. It was illegal at the time as well, but there wasn't proper enforcement of those laws. So it takes time for things to change, but hopefully the tide is turning. Also been involved in petitions for places like Cyprus and Malta in terms of of the illegal trapping of songbirds that happens there too. So this is a big problem. And here in Ireland, petitions over the curlew, also consultations for the European Union. That's very important as well. A lot of us don't seem to realise that we as European citizens have a right to have a say in what happens. So I think petitions can be a very valuable tool.
Okay, Richard and Aina are back with us now. Richard's in Malahide, Aina is in County Clare. Aina, have a listen to this WhatsApp, which has come into us from Merrow Ward along the banks of the Royal Canal.
Hi, Derek. I'm contacting you about herons on the Royal Canal near Crosscuns Bridge in Phibsborough. A couple of days ago, while I was walking by the canal in the early evening, I was really surprised to see the usually shy blue heron approaching people and accepting food from them. I'm sure it's not a great idea for people to be feeding them. The herons usually appear to be quite happy foraging for themselves at the edge of the water. And hopefully, when people have gone back to their pubs or their restaurants, and when things return to relative normality for the rest of us, the herons can go back to feeding in their natural habitat without help from humans.
Thanks, Derek. Oh, sorry, Merrow. I'm jumping in on top of you. Thank you very much indeed, Merrow. You can send your WhatsApp to 087-708-7031. If we don't use it this week, we can have a listen and maybe get to it next week. Aina, any comments on that?
Yeah, I think this is just mad. I mean, we were talking last week about feeding gulls and that gulls learn the behaviour of attacking people for food because we have fed them. Now, a gull is one thing, but Lord, if you've seen a heron and the beak on a heron, the heron has a really long, sharp beak. So feeding herons is mad. And this heron obviously approaches people because people have been given food to them. People think it's great. Sure, it's only a jumped up duck. People feed ducks too. We should not feed wild birds. We should, I mean, like that in the wild, okay, you feed your garden birds in winter, that's a different story. But I mean, this heron is a carnivore. He spends his time on the riverbank catching fish, catching eels, catching frogs, whatever he can catch.
Yeah, they eat ducklings as well.
Feeding them? Oh, they'll eat ducklings too, they will indeed, and anything they can get their beaks around. So what are people feeding them? Are they giving them sandwiches? So, I mean, unless you're throwing baby eels or fish, I mean, if you go up to the zoo, the man in the zoo who feeds the sea lions, the herons all arrive on the roof because the Phoenix Park ones have, they know they can set their watches to 3 o'clock and they can know when the feeding is going to happen. And on the days when they don't feed the sea lions, the poor old herons can't read the sign and they're there waiting anyway, and the keeper will throw them the odd fish which they catch in the air. But feeding herons along the canal is a recipe for disaster because they're going to end. I mean, they're not stupid. If they think people are going to feed them, they're going to approach people. If people aren't feeding them quick enough, well, what'll they do next? So my advice is do not do it. Do not feed herons on the canal. It's madness.
Richard Collins.
Derek, I would be very careful with herons. Remember, the bird is in a bit of a dither. You know that word, dither.
Mm-hmm.
It's torn between two forces. I used to see this with swans, a swan that I'm trying to lure close to me. They are frightened at one stage. One side of them is saying, get out of here fast before you get into trouble. And the other side is saying, that's a nice juicy bit of food. I'd like it. So they're torn between those two things. And the result is often a kind of aggression. They get very aggressive when in that uncertain state of mind. And a heron would be quite like that. Swans certainly are. They hiss at you aggressively and then they take a piece of bread from you the next second. So in that situation, anything can happen. Remember, it's a very unnatural predicament.
So don't feed them. Stay well clear is the advice from both Aina and Richard. And no better people to give you advice.
Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031. Email mooney@rte.ie.
We had a competition last week which we ran on the website, and the question was, one stamp features, it was to do with the Unpost new edition stamps which featured the flora and fauna, and it said one stamp features the white prominent moth, which was thought to be extinct in Britain and Ireland before it reappeared in which Irish county in 2008, and you had to give the answer, and the answer was County Kerry, and the winner is Annette Gardner from Galway. So we've sent her out a beautiful presentation. There's a message in here from Cork. It says, recently recently rooks were drying their wings on our neighbour's chimney at about 4:30 p.m. when the fire was lit, amazingly, ignoring the heavy smoke. Were they really drying their wings? Well, possibly. Who knows? Would the smoke be killing all the parasites, etc., etc.?
They're fumigating their wings, so they're known for the smoke bathing, it's called. It kills the parasites, indeed.
So that's exactly what they were doing.
Exactly.
Well, you learn. Well, I kind of knew it. But anyway, you learn something.
In the back of your head somewhere.
We're joined now by Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. And you must be really lapping it up at the moment. The weather is beautiful. The place must be packed today. And you've got lovely sun in your face.
Yep, exactly. And I've been enjoying the sun like everyone else outside. And here we are in the studio, out of the sun.
And was it busy?
Very, very.
Very busy.
Which
and
is great.
I take it they're taking their litter home with them, are they?
We've not had bins in the gardens now for close on 15, 16 years. And our visitors have learnt if you bring litter in, you take it home with you. And it is a very efficient sort of idea that needs to be spread around.
Because it's something we're going to be talking with to Mick Power from Quilta. He's the manager of the National Estates on behalf of Quilta, some 7% of the land mass of Ireland, tomorrow evening on Mooney Goes Wild on Monday night. But Dublin city centre today is an absolute mess. I went for a walk early on today before we started work and the place is a disaster. I mean, there's literally, I mean, Temple Bar is a disaster area. How do you stop it? You've never really come across this problem in the gardens, have you?
Not in the gardens, but we've certainly got it at some of our other sites. So the Office of Public Works runs a lot of varied sites, Phoenix Park being one of the biggest, of course. But yes, it is a problem. It's a huge problem this year more than any other year because of the number of takeaway cartons and cups and so on. So we're exploring all sorts of ways just to bring about that sort of peer pressure from everyone else around you so that people follow the simple code that if you collect any litter from, you know, what you're eating or using, take it home with you.
Well, I hope you do. Let's face it, most people listening to this programme probably care about nature and are not inclined to be leaving stuff behind them. But if you see people who are, if you're brave enough, be careful, maybe say it to them or just kind of give them a dirty look. Dirty looks work occasionally. Although, mind you, Niall did tell me to stare down the gulls the next time it's looking for my sandwich. And I did try it during the week and it didn't work. I think it thought I was making a pass at it. It stood there and looked glaringly into my eye. Anyway, Matthew, photosynthesis. Remind everybody what photosynthesis is and why you're here to talk about it.
Photosynthesis is a beautiful reaction, and it is the ability of green plants on this planet to capture sunlight and do two things. One is to take molecules of water and rip them into parts so that the hydrogen atoms are removed and oxygen is released. And it also takes carbon dioxide and builds it into sugars. So it runs the carbon cycle and the oxygen cycle. And without photosynthesis, you and I would not be here. So it is absolutely vital to the biosphere. And just this week, a most extraordinary publication has appeared. This was done by work of geneticists in Imperial College in London. And one of the bits of knowledge we have is that 4 billion years ago, biological life started on this planet. And from looking at its DNA of everything from bacteria to plants to animals, we know we have a common ancestor, a single universal common ancestor to all life on this planet. What is also extraordinary is bacteria in the oceans, huge numbers of them are photosynthetic. They are capturing sunlight just as plants do on the land surface. And we also know from their DNA that these bacteria are actually living inside the land plants. So the green plants that we see growing around us have got photosynthetic bacteria living inside the cells, and they form something called a chloroplast. Mm-hmm. So they share the same reaction of photosynthesis between these bacteria and these land plants. But the big question is, when did photosynthesis start? So we know biological life started 4 billion years ago. About 2.5 billion years ago, the oxygen starts to appear in the atmosphere. Before then, the atmosphere was made of methane, carbon dioxide, nitrogen. It was totally inhospitable to biological life. And suddenly it converts into oxygen so that by 1 billion years ago, the whole atmosphere has been built and sort of multicellular life, trilobites and coelacanths, dinosaurs and mammals, birds, they all appear on this planet. So what these scientists at Imperial College have done is they've looked at the DNA sequences in these photosynthetic bacteria and in these plants, and they've worked out, well, when did this extraordinary reaction, this ability to split water, evolve? And they base this upon something called ancestral sequence analysis. So you look at the common ancestor of two genes and you can see how they've changed. And therefore you can, using mathematics, work out what the original ancestor would have, the sequence would have been. And by this process, they have extended the origin of photosynthesis back to 4 billion years. Oh. Now, what's extraordinary about this is most bacteria are not photosynthetic. They consume things. They create diseases and so on. So we're used to most bacteria just rotting things down. But what this work has demonstrated is all these other bacteria have actually lost the ability for photosynthesis, and it is as old as life itself. So it began right at the very beginning. And that is an astonishing thing, because all the up until very recently, scientists have assumed that this ability to split water molecules was so complicated and so clever. They thought, well, this is too complicated to have evolved early on, and it's taken billions of years to appear after the first life. But no, it appears through this analysis of sequences that it is very, very ancient indeed.
So we're going to have to change the script. In the beginning, there was photosynthesis, Aina.
Exactly.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, photosynthesis is a carbon base, because the oxygen that the H2O, the water, is split, and then the hydrogen then combines with carbon to give us carbohydrates. But there also are bacteria, and they're very ancient as well, that had nothing to do with carbon. They lived away down at the bottoms of the oceans, and they're still there. And these use sulfur, and some of them used iron as their inorganic molecule rather than carbon. And they were able quite well to live on these instead and produce methane, produce not carbon at all, not increase the oxygen levels in the atmosphere. And those bacteria are still there to this day, because when they go down in their ancient machines, they can go down 2 or 3 miles in the ocean, they can see these smoke holes, these geysers, giving off quantities of stuff that comes up from the centre of the earth. And this is where these deposits of sulfur or iron are causing these bacteria to be able to be still alive. So you're not messing when you're dealing with bacteria, because they have been able to keep an existence going from the very beginning of time, from the very beginning of life on Earth. So it's fascinating that they've been able to go backwards with the photosynthesis, rather than saying, first of all, there were bacteria and then eventually photosynthesis happened. That the fact they were able to do it at all, however poorly, over a period of millions of years, changed the content of carbon in the atmosphere then to allow evolution to happen at a much faster rate and bigger organisms to increase. And in fact, if the oxygen levels are higher in the atmosphere, the animals will be even bigger again, because the size of creatures depends on the amount of oxygen. And we had huge, enormous dragonflies at one point way back. We see their remains in fossil records, which are much smaller than they are now, because we don't have the same amounts of oxygen in the atmosphere as then. So it'll be interesting when climate change really takes hold. We have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The world is getting warmer, and photosynthesis depends on the availability of CO2 and on temperature for it to go faster. This will affect things again and change how photosynthesis changes the atmosphere in which our world is. So it's great stuff.
It is. And I think energy production using photosynthesis is an area of intense research. And this oxygen evolving complex that is involved in this photosynthetic reaction where water is split is something there's a lot of interest in. Because if we can generate something that physically will generate oxygen and hydrogen from sunlight, we will solve our energy production at a stroke.
It's an amazingly efficient system as well, isn't it, the way that it works? And I know that some listeners may think, well, how does this relate to me? But basically, all the energy that we get in our diets comes ultimately from photosynthesis, either from eating animals that have eaten plants that have got their sugars from that, or directly from those plants. And I think it's really amazing just how crucial this is to the circle of life. We don't really think of that, but if it wasn't for that, as you said, Matthew, we wouldn't be here. It really is amazing.
It is it's a beautiful thing too, because it is so complicated. It, on the face of it, it sounds simple. It's you're taking carbons to make sugars, and you're taking water to generate oxygen, and they seem fairly sort of straightforward reactions. But in order to do that, to mess around at the molecular level and the atomic level, and the photosystem too that generates this oxygen, it literally traps 4 photons of light, and using the energy from that snaps off these 2 hydrogen atoms and generates oxygen. It is quite astonishing, because that oxygen is incredibly reactive and will destroy any biological life. It will consume it. It's like setting fire to something, almost, having oxygen as single atoms. So the whole complex is designed to make sure those oxygens join together to make an oxygen molecule of 2 oxygen atoms, and then it's safe. It's not going to burn up the cell.
It really is remarkable. It really is. Just, you couldn't design it yourself. It'd be amazing technology, really.
Richard.
Yes, I saw a figure somebody computed that the amount of energy coming in through photosynthesis from the sun is 8 times that the total energy that human beings produce. So that's a very interesting statistic. We're 1/8 of the capacity of the photosynthetic system worldwide. Matthew, the primitive enzymes that produced the early oxygen, and way back 3.5-4 billion years ago, is there a continuity between that and the system that the cyanobacteria developed in 2.5 billion years ago? Was there an evolution of technique, of chemical change, and so on? Is there a break? Are there 2 systems of distinct systems of photosynthesis, or does one evolve into the other?
One evolves into the other, and what previously has held people back is the idea that it is so complicated and difficult to have generated this. It was assumed that this 2 billion year lag before oxygen production really got going indicated how difficult it was. But now we realize it's ancient, and the efficiency of it had to build up so that 2.5 billion years ago, it really kicked off, which is known as the Great Oxygenation Event, which is what brought in, heralded the biosphere we see today.
Well, Matthew, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Just to remind people that if they want to catch up with the RTE Eye on Nature Wildlife Photographic Competition display, it was in the Botanic Gardens. Where is it now?
It's now moved to Portumna Castle in the Midlands. So that is now open, and you can see the 12 finalists and the 8 recommended runners-up on display there at Portumna Castle for the rest of the summer.
Well, go in and have a look, and we'll be running that competition again next year. We'll start in January, so have a look at what you're up against. Let's take a break.
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087-708-7031.
And you can send those in any day during the week. We'll have a listen to them and hopefully get around to perhaps using some of them next week. That's pretty much all we have time for today. Thank you very much indeed for your company. Thanks also to Richard Collins, Aina Nilauna, Niall Hatch and Dr. Matthew Jebb. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Bella Riley. On sound we had Mark O'Dwyer, and our producer in studio today was Anna Leddy. We'll do it all again. We'll do it all again tomorrow night on RT Radio 1 from 10 p.m. And 10 p.m. What's wrong with me? Until then, bye!
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney.